Welcome to The Telegram. I'm Tim Stanley. Terror in the streets of London. On Wednesday, two men beheaded a British soldier in a street in Woolwich while crying Allahu Akbar. As Britain recovers from this shocking attack, we ask, how was this able to happen? What will the consequences be? And is Britain sliding into religious extremism? I'm joined in the studio by Shashank Joshi, a research fellow at the Royal United Services Institute, Peter Oborn, the Daily Telegraph's chief political commentator, and Janet Daly, a Sunday Telegraph columnist. The murder of a British soldier in Woolwich raises questions about just how secure our country really is. Here's what we know at this point. The attack was likely motivated by Islamic extremism, the perpetrators were British of Nigerian origin, and other people have been searched or detained in relation to the attack in Greenwich and Lincolnshire. Religious people across the country have united in condemning the incident, and the Prime Minister has urged us all to trust the security forces and keep calm and carry on. But how calm should we really feel? I want to start by asking Shashank Joshi, what are the security forces going to be looking for in the next few days?
Well, what they always look for is links to anything known, links to organisations in perhaps Somalia, Nigeria, if there's a diaspora link here, even places like Pakistan and Yemen. The problem here is this attack may embody a trend we've seen in a number of places, which is the sort of decentralisation of jihad, that is do-it-yourself jihad, inspired by Al-Qaeda's magazine, actually called Inspire, which urges things like knock over someone with a car. And when Osama bin Laden read this, you know, there's some letters from his compound in Abbottabad, he said, what is this? This is absolute nonsense. Knocking someone over with a car, you know, hitting someone with a knife, this is ridiculous. But actually, it's proven to be a very effective form of spreading violence and mayhem. And we saw the same process at work in Boston. The pressure cooker used in the attack was from a recipe by Al-Qaeda's magazine Inspire. So those links tend to be missing. In this particular case, they were on MI5's radar. So the first priority is to see, was there any central direction from abroad?
Right. And there is some indication they knew Anjem Chowdhury, a radical preacher. So there may be some connection there.
Yes, Chowdhury suggested that one of the attackers visited was a member of his band organisation, and that he knew him in that capacity. It's possible that's where he was radicalised. There are suggestions he was a convert from Christianity about 10 years ago, but beyond that, we have no idea what his specific grievances may have been. Of course, he gave a rambling speech on British soldiers killing Muslims in combat, alluding to Afghanistan, although not saying it by name. But of course, there could be a complex, incoherent mess of grievances at work here.
Right. But if we're talking about a situation in which there is no coherent network, like the way we might understand a conspiracy, it becomes very difficult to know exactly what we should do at all to stop things like this.
It does. I mean, one of the suggestions is you stop the incitement, you stop the radicalisation in the first place. And certainly Baroness Neville Jones suggested that today. The problem is this works sometimes. You know, we know MI6 hacked into the Inspire magazine and replaced all of its recipes for bombs with those for cupcakes. An ingenious approach, but actually the fact is that's one side of it. The other side of it is hate preachers like Anwar Olaki, who was killed in a drone strike a couple of years ago. You know, in that sense, just as the bomber will always get through, that message of that propaganda, the incitement to violence, will always get through. And I think we have to be very, very careful in how we respond, because the bigger context here is we are also in a struggle with countries like Russia and China, who wish to close down the internet, shut down the flow of information. I think we have to be very careful how we respond before we jump in their direction.
Right. But it does seem to me that it's important to control the message. I mean, that's what I'm inferring from what you're saying. And Peter, does this not make the case for something like the Snoopers Charter? Should we not be trying to stop this kind of incendiary information and ideas getting to people before it does? Should we not be tracing what it is people are saying to each other and keeping tabs on them?
I don't see that at all. In a funny way, I think it makes a case against the Snoopers Charter. There is a mess of inchoate grievances behind this troubled, demented individual. And I think the more that those grievances can be expressed in the open, you know, he's clearly very alarmed about Iraq and Afghanistan, and it's very important that people are able to express their concern about those kind of grievances. And so long as they can be part of the democratic discussion of, in this country, the better. I think if we start to go down the Baroness Neville Jones line of trying to stop people talking, the worse we make it. And that was a lesson, of course, from the IRA in the 1980s.
But we're not just talking about people talking about criticising British foreign policy. And I presume that what she's talking about is stopping people inciting specific acts.
Well, I mean, there's laws against that already.
Right, but how can we enforce those laws? How can we police that if we can't access private data? If we can't find out what it is people are saying to each other?
Well, I would say the issue here is not necessarily private communication. That sort of radicalisation does occur. We did see emails, for example, between Anwar Olaki when he was alive and Major, I think it was Nidal Hussein in America for the Fort Hood shootings. But that's relatively rare. What we're talking about here is YouTube videos, for example, videos
right.
that are being broadcast in here and can be accessed by anyone.
Janet.
Yeah. Can I say, I have a problem here distinguishing between freelance Al-Qaeda operatives and wacko fantasists. You know, wacko fantasists
Absolutely.
Have always been with us. Now, this business about the internet or Twitter or the dissemination of information through electronic means, there is a precedent for this, almost an exact precedent, oddly enough, for this wave of freelance violence, and that is in the late 19th century, the anarchist movement, which killed a president, actually, assassinated President McKinley in 1901, which blew up the Gare Saint-Lazare in France, which blew up the Greenwich Observatory in the 1880s. This managed to spread itself without the help of the internet or any electronic media, and it had a strangely similar kind of nihilistic, loving death, sort of suicidal kind of mania about it. These things tend to go, it seems like a trivial thing to say, but in fashions, a kind of intellectual fashion. And it's very, very difficult, without creating thought crimes, to eliminate the insemination of it. Now, I think there's a really, I agree with Peter about this, I think there's a really serious danger that we could end up clamping down on the freedom of dialogue, freedom of expression. It's already a crime to incite violence or to incite murder. That's not a problem. We have a law against that.
Yeah, but it has to be policed.
Sure, but to start making laws against the dissemination of what could be inflammatory dialogue or inflammatory information, I mean, that is a serious step toward a totalitarian state. And under totalitarianism, you tend to get even more violent reaction against oppression. That can't be
the It could actually be what the terrorists wanted
exactly.
to happen.
Exactly, mm-hmm. exactly.
To pick up on what you've just said, I think a very interesting point there is this distinction between what is a terrorist act and what is simply an act of madness.
Yeah.
I mean, I infer from what you were saying about the anarchists that the idea of anarchy gave mad, angry people some excuse or some way of articulating their madness and their
anger.
Yeah,
the peculiar thing was that when you read the script, the texts of a lot of this anarchist movement and Proudhon and so on, these were very often people who were perfectly sane in the technical sense and who were just deeply aggrieved, had, you know, personal grievances. Many of them were kind of misfits. They were kind of outcasts from society. There are such people in every generation, in every, you know, this is part of the human condition. And if they, the great discovery of the anarchist movement in the 19th century was dynamite. That was the invention of dynamite was the great gift to the anarchist movement. And now we've got all sorts of sort of amateur concoctions and recipes for creating violence. And then again, we have these machetes and meat cleavers and things which go right back to a much more primitive way of attacking people.
Right.
Unfortunately,
right.
not. I mean, it is. The machete, of course, is the weapon of choice in these terrible outbreaks which happen in Nigeria at the moment.
Yes,
I mean,
and it was in the Congo too. Yeah.
Shashank, if this is the action of two men who are not part of a wider network, who could well be emotionally or mentally disturbed, is it right to class it as terrorism?
Yes, I think it is. And I think it is, first of all, because they directed this against a non-combatant. This wasn't in the field in Afghanistan. This wasn't on a battlefield. But most of all, they had clear political statements. Whether sane or not, one of them stood up to camera and was engaged in, again, a classic trope of the anarchist movement, propaganda of the deed. Stood up, wanted to be filmed, wanted to be caught, perhaps wanted suicide by cop, and said very clearly, overthrow your government, they don't care about you. And of course, his message has absolutely no resonance amongst any segment of British opinion, but I would say that is a fairly classic act of terror.
But if, for example, in America, whenever there is a school shooting, very often the deranged person involved leaves some kind of manifesto behind. Now, I've never understood why it is that we would class what they do as simply an act of criminality. But when the Fort Hood shooting happened, a man who was clearly very mentally distressed, who I sense latched on to Islamism as a way of articulating that distress, that's described as terrorism, but the school shootings are not.
Yes, I think that's right. But I would say, if we look back at the attack on the federal building by Timothy McVeigh, if we look at Anders Breivik's attack in Norway, these were also clearly political attacks. The politics of them was very different. It was anti-government in one case, anti-immigrant in another case. But just because one motive is Islamic in nature, the other one is secular or nationalist, ultra-nationalist, doesn't make it any less an act of terror, I'd say.
But
we need to be very open about saying that, I think.
I suppose what I'm groping for here is I fear that there will be a specific backlash against Muslims in this incident that there isn't necessarily shown towards white people involved in white supremacist terrorism.
Yes, I think that's right. I think you didn't see very much, you didn't see very many a great violent backlash against nationalists in Norway, but you have seen absolutely abhorrent reaction by anti-Islamist groups in the UK, particularly the EDL here. But I think the important thing is they have essentially failed in their objective to sow those divisions.
Janet?
The EDL demonstration was pretty pathetic. Very small number of people who look like football hooligans, you know, I mean, and mercifully, it doesn't seem to have been resonant with the white community generally. And I have to say that in the response to this, the official Muslim community has been quite splendid. I mean, there was a marvelous statement today by the head of the MCB, very, very strong, who said that the Nigerian guy who was responsible for making this statement to camera, when they were shouting Allahu Akbar, that was virtually blasphemous as far as he was concerned, that it was a desanctifying of the most sacred statement of Muslim faith. He said it was a barbaric act, you know, which was completely unacceptable and unjustified by any Muslim tenet. I mean, his statement was totally uncompromising and excellent.
And if we can move on to the question of what the backlash is going to be, I think I slightly disagree with your characterization of the EDL's response. I mean, you're right. Of course, they are just drunken hooligans and violent thugs. But it was very swift.
And also,
it was remarkably well choreographed.
There wasn't there a report of three attacks on mosques overnight, or is that not?
Yes, there were. There were knife attacks on a mosque, arson attacks on a mosque, certainly reported last night.
Peter, the backlash isn't just going to be the EDL. There's likely to be, the British public are likely to react in an emotional way to this story. What do you think the consequences of it could be?
Yeah, it flows into a narrative which I believe to be a false narrative about British Muslims, which is that they are people who are somehow hostile to the British state and are hostile to our way of life. And that's one of the things which does worry me about this episode, which is obviously terrible, but it's quite small. It isn't comparable to 7/7, which was a ghastly act of mass murder. This is one murder. And I'm rather sympathetic to what you were suggesting, is that although there may be public motives, political motives, there's also an act of somebody's deranged inside their own heads. You know, they don't appear to have been part of any kind of, not being instructed by some more malign mind outside. And so I think there is a danger, and it is part of something which I think the British media need to think about. I've noticed a tendency in the media recently, a whole series of stories, where a single event dominates, and so every newspaper, the first 10 pages of every newspaper. I couldn't understand why Cobra was called particularly last night. I thought they were getting quite overexcited. The political class love it too, because it affirms the centrality of politicians. It's obviously desperate, terribly sad, and the images are powerful. It doesn't seem to me to have necessarily, unless it's followed by a sequence of other similar events, to be an event of enormous importance. Mm.
Janet, do you agree with
that?
Yes,
I do, actually, yes. And I think there is a danger of creating a fashion, as it were, creating a kind of idolatrous image of these people, you know, and that
for people who might be sympathetic or for people who are frightened.
For people who are
them.
Impressionable,
right?
Either way,
do you think ITV was right to show the footage that it showed?
That's a difficult question. on the whole, I tend not to want to censor things. So on the whole, I would say, show what, if it's true, if it happened, show it. But I, in this case, I do wonder if there shouldn't be a bit of discretion.
Tim, can I just make one broad point in terms of echo Peter's idea? This is, by and large, a very small event, and it's worth emphasising that, because 5 or 6 years ago, we would have been talking about plots hatched in Pakistan from Al-Qaeda core that were top-down involving explosives on planes. Last year, the last time that occurred, last time we had a plot by Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula to bring another underpants bomb onto a plane, and it was foiled thanks to fantastic intelligence work by not only us but the Americans and the Saudis as well. The fact is, this represents the utter failure of global jihad and its devolution to a local insignificant level. Al-Qaeda core is being chased from place to place by drones, intelligence work and sound law enforcement work, and it's resorted to this kind of pathetic attack.
I take what you mean, but you could see it the other way and say that this is actually why terror can never be defeated or entirely expunged, precisely because it's so decentralised and amateur.
But that's like saying human wickedness can never be expunged.
Right.
You know?
Right.
There are always going to be loons, there are always going to be deranged people. There are always going to be people with grievances who will do violent things. That's life, you know. And the fact that it happens to fall under the category of Islamic terrorism, you know, it is not preventable. That's true.
But I do think this was an exceptional incident because it felt like the importing of something that I think people normally associate with stuff that happens abroad into this country.
What about 3 years ago, the sword attack on, was it Stephen Timms, by a crazed student from King's College who was arrested? No
right.
links, 3 years on, no outside links have been found from that attack, which was, again, self-described as being motivated by the Iraq War. You know, this is not the first time such plots have been hatched, not only against British soldiers, against Territorial Army barracks a while ago, but also other groups.
Glasgow
so
Airport.
I honestly think this is, you know, we have a precedent for this.
We do, but I think, if I can speak on behalf of listeners who may disagree, that there is a growing worry in this country that our cities are becoming segregated by religious extremes. Not just Islamic extremism, there's also a growing Pentecostal movement in London. And there's a feeling among many British people they're very uneasy about, that the country is sort of sliding into something that they feel belongs overseas.
I think those fears need to be put in the context of roughly 2005, 2006. You cast your mind back then, the security services and our intelligence agencies were petrified of what may have been festering, brewing in those places, in segregated cities and places. They looked at places like France and the banlieue uprisings there. They looked at the Netherlands. Those fears never really transpired. And if this is as bad as it gets, I would say they would look back and think we did a pretty damn good job.
Peter.
I completely agree with that. I mean, I'd even go a little bit further. I completely agree with Janet that the condemnations by the Muslim community have been exemplary. I'm not even certain they need to make them in the sense that, I mean, they're Brits like the rest of us. Why are they particularly being held to account for this act of barbarism in a South London street? I don't see it as Islamic, I don't see it as Muslim, I just see it as deranged.
Shashank, Peter and Janet, thank you very much. For more opinion and commentary, you can find us at telegraph.co.uk.